so are there any questions from Monday's lecture?
Dr. Murath was interested if you have any of his
It's coming up. So I just wanted to quickly sort of some of the highlights of what we went over on Monday. So we talked about, growth, skeletal muscle growth. I said primarily occurs by hypertrophy. In general, the thought is that hypertrophic growth is the result of a net increase in protein synthesis. So in general, the thought is that protein degradation doesn't change a whole lot in terms of hypertrophic growth. So really, it is an increase in protein synthesis. We touched quickly on the difference between translational efficiency. We'll talk more about that. We might get into some of that today, but definitely next week. The comparison or the translational efficiency compared to translational capacity. That's where we start talking about ribosomes, ribosome biogenesis. But what we did focus on were the primary stem cell population in skeletal muscle, referred to as satellite cells. All right. I don't want to give you the impression that there are not other stem cell populations. There are. But the primary, the most abundant, is generally considered to be stem cells. We touched briefly that these stem cells are important for muscle regeneration, but I think you guys are going to talk about that later in the semester with Charlotte. And then we got into the notion of myonuclear domain, right? So muscle is, I agree, but most people argue that skeletal muscle is the most important cell in the body. That's a joke. You're like, yep, I totally agree with that. But it is, there are some things about skeletal muscle that are very unique. And one is that they are multinucleated. There's only, I can think of, trophoblasts? Probably you might know that. There's a couple cell types that also are cardiomyocytes can have, and typically they're have a couple of nuclei, but in terms of being multinucleated, there's very few tissues that are multinucleated, which is beyond the scope of this class, but I think it's a really interesting question to ask, why are they multinucleated? And in asking that question, people have come to the conclusion that they must be multinucleated for a purpose. And part of that leads into the concept of myonuclear domain, that each nuclei oversees a certain amount of cytoplasm. And some of the support for that notion is we showed during postnatal development, right? You have using the mouse EDL muscle as sort of a representation of what is going on during postnatal development. You start with about 50 nuclei per fiber, and during the next 3 weeks, which is typically considered postnatal development, though it goes on longer, you go from about having 50 nuclei up to about 250 nuclei per fiber. And so that's about a five-fold increase in the number of nuclei per fiber, but there's almost a seven-fold increase in the size of the muscle fiber, the muscle cell. All right, and then we talked about PAX7, right? It's a transcription factor that's only expressed in satellite cells in skeletal muscle. All right, I don't want to give you the impression PAX7 is expressed in other tissues, primarily the brain, but in skeletal muscle, PAX7 is only expressed in satellite cells. So it's a satellite cell-specific marker, right? And then, so if you knock out PAX7 in the mouse, what happens is PAX7 is necessary for the renewal of satellite cells. So what happens is these mice, PAX7 knockout mice, are born with their full complement of satellite cells, and then during that postnatal development, what happens is because they don't have PAX7, they can't renew that stem cell population, so in effect, they deplete their satellite cells. And as a result, They are smaller. They often don't survive. And so that's kind of led to this notion that you need additional nuclei for a muscle to grow. Okay? And so what our field has done is extended that notion into adult skeletal muscle, adult hypertrophic growth. And to support that idea, we do know, like we have different models. I introduced a model of synergistic ablation, where you remove a muscle and the remaining muscle has to assume the functional responsibilities of the muscle that you took out. And as a result of that model, what we see is we see a significant increase in the number of myonuclei, consistent with the idea that for a muscle to grow and to maintain this myonuclear domain, you have to get additional myonuclei. And because what I said is, again, the general thought, and there's not much evidence to the contrary, that myonuclei are post-mitotic, meaning that they are unable to re-enter the cell cycle and replicate. So if you have an increase in myonuclear abundance, or you'll hear me say myonuclear accretion, the question is, where are those nuclei coming from? And the general consensus in the field, and I presented data to support that, that those additional nuclei that you see in the muscle fiber with hypertrophy are coming from satellite cells. So satellite cells are typically quiescent. They become activated in response to a hypertrophic signal. They proliferate, right? And one daughter cell is going to self-renew, remain a satellite cell, and the other will begin to differentiate into like a myoblast. And it will fuse to the muscle fiber and in that way donate its nuclei. And that's how we increase myonuclear number. And then what we finished with is, I talked about how there was some debate in the field about is this increase in myonuclear number necessary for hypertrophic growth? And so we developed a model which allowed us to conditionally or inducibly kill satellite cells in adult skeletal muscle, and then we subjected those mice to hypertrophy. And what we found was, I went through all the data and showed you, the hypertrophic response was completely the same regardless of whether you had satellite cells or didn't. So we got muscle hypertrophy independent of satellite cells. And so some people were happy about that, and some people were not happy about that. So that brings us to today. Do you have a question?
Nope, she was just practicing, so I brought it over today.
Okay.
Usually I have to ask her for
paper. Oops. Okay, so here was our paper that we published back in 2011. And this last summer, this paper came out. Satellite cell depletion prevents fiber hypertrophy in skeletal muscle.
Uh-oh.
These guys repeated, or so they said, they repeated our study. They said identically, and they got exactly the opposite results. So as a scientist, you see this, and you're like, uh-oh. Because you take a lot of pride, and you try to be very careful in the experiments that you've done. And since this time, Mitsunari was the guy who did most of the surgeries. And since that time, we've had numerous other graduate students and postdocs do the experiment, and we've always got the same result. Now, just to give you some insight, because I think it's kind of an interesting story, Gunderson actually contacted us about a year before he published this paper, and he sent us all his data, which is really nice. That's sort of the ideals of science, like, hey, guys, what is going on? And, of course, we were, like, in a panic. And so we began to really look at his data and genuinely try to understand, why is there a discrepancy between these two laboratories, presumably using the same mice and doing the same experiments. And so one thing that we zeroed in on was that his mice were slightly younger than our mice. Unfortunately, he wasn't interested in pursuing that line of research. I think he just wanted to take us down. That's my personal feeling. But in any case, so if what I mentioned previously is one thing that we do with our mice is, because we're really interested in understanding adult skeletal muscle plasticity. In this case, we're talking about hypertrophy. So we want to make sure that the mouse is fully mature. And so we've always chosen 4 months, and we picked that because we looked in the literature and they said, long bone growth is pretty complete at about 4 months of age. So we don't ablate satellite cells until the mice are 4 months old. Most people you'll see, you know, they'll do experiments in mice that are 2 or 3 months old. You know, they're old enough to breed. They should be, you know, they're sexually mature. So the thought is their muscles should be completely developed. So we said, okay, let's go ahead and let's do, because he said his mice were 2 to 3 months old, something in that range. Kind of changed when the paper came out, but in any case. So, postdoc in the lab, Kevin, and then started with by another postdoc, Sarah, said, okay, I'm going to take mice that are 2 months old, and he actually repeated to mice that are 4 months old. And remember, what we did was we treat the mice with tamoxifen. And tamoxifen is what you do to... No photographs, please. No photographs. Yeah. To induce... remember, we talked about the Cre-ER. So tamoxifen will activate the Cre-ER, goes in, deletes that stop cassette, and then we get activation of diphtherium toxin. So we did exactly the same experiments. And so what he's showing you here, again, this is the experimental design, and then he's just showing you this PAC7 staining. And so here we have young, which were treated with tamoxifen at 2 months of age, or you have what we're referring to now as mature. And basically what he's trying to show is, well, these bars here, the light green and the light blue, this is... the shams, so that would be your baseline, and he's basically just showing you that, in fact, under resting conditions, we're able to deplete satellite cells, right? And this is what we talked about on Monday. Again, the same thing, that our model works very well. We're able to deplete satellite cells, okay? And then in response to OV, so that is one acronym that we use for synergist ablation, for its overload, mechanical overload, right? When you remove that gastrocnemius, you leave behind the plantaris muscle, and that puts a mechanical overload on the plantaris, and that's in part why why hypertrophies. So that's the OV, and so what he's just showing you here is in response to mechanical overload, there's a significant increase, as we talked about on Monday, in the number of PAC7 positive cells, which in a muscle is satellite cells. Okay, so this is just showing you that, in fact, with satellite cells, you see this nice increase in both young and mature muscle. And then here are the mice that were treated with tamoxifen that have no satellite cells. And again, 90% of them are depleted. Okay, and just, you know, pure transparency, when we treat mice with tamoxifen, the model is not perfect. So what we actually do is we have to pick mice that show a high level of depletion. Sometimes mice might only be 75% depleted of their satellite cells. And so we say, okay, well, we don't want to use those mice because that's going to be confounding, right? Why we see a difference in mice, we really don't know. Females tend to show much higher level of ablation in satellite cells compared to males. But again, why that is, it's one of those things that would be interesting to figure out, but in terms of the practicality of having a lab and having people spend their efforts on something that's meaningful, we really don't. We just never tried to pursue it. I think one of the interesting things, again, though, is that these remaining satellite cells they never recover, right? So we know under this sort of hypertrophic environment, we get an increase in satellite cells. So why don't these few remaining ones, why don't they respond? And again, we have no idea why that is, but they never come back. So I don't think I'll get it. I won't talk about it. But we've done studies where we've ablated satellite cells in four-month-old mice and let them age for another couple of years. And those satellite cells never come back. These guys just did a study, though, where we took the same mice, segue here, but where they ran them for, we ablated satellite cells, and then we ran them for about a year. And so it'll be really interesting to see if in response to prolonged exercise, right, repeated, do these satellite cells recover? Okay, so this just shows that our model works, that in the shams or the vehicle treated, you get the same increase in satellite cells in response to hypertrophic stimulus. And then here, what Kevin is showing is what you should, here he has, these are, we can isolate single fibers. And then what he's showing here, these lines are sort of the boundaries of the single fiber. He's just showing you a segment. And then the little white dots are the nuclei. And so what he literally does is isolate the single fibers, and then he can measure the distance that he, you know, the length, and then he counts the number of nuclei. And so he can say, what are the number of nuclei per length of fiber? And so what he's showing you here is, again, in these would be the vehicle-treated, or think of wild-type muscle. Again, you have the young and the mature, and what you see is an increase in the number of myonuclei. Okay, this is just confirming, I mean, it has a ton of work, right? And he's literally repeating the study that we did back in 2011, and in addition, he's throwing in young mice, right? So this is just validating what we saw 6 years ago. And again, you don't see any increase in the number of myonuclei, which is what you would expect, right? Because there's no satellite cells, nothing to donate their nucleus. And again, he's able to completely block that in the young. Okay? So everything looks good. We can ablate satellite cells. We can prevent myonuclear accretion in response to a hypertrophic stimulus. And then here is the big part. So again, here he's just showing you, these are representative images of, so we focus on the plantaris muscle. This is cross-section, so he quantifies the size, the cross-sectional area of the muscle fibers. All right. So what he shows here in the young, it was trending to significance, just missed. But again, in the the vehicle treated or think wild type, you see almost a significant 0.05 is typically considered significant increase in the cross-sectional area of the muscle fiber. Right? And again, you see the same thing here. Now, here's where, this is the big part, ready? Again, what we saw in the mature is previously what we published. We see an increase in the cross-sectional area. But look here, in a young 8-week-old mouse that has no satellite cells or satellite cells significantly depleted, we actually did not see an increase in the cross-sectional area. So, apparently, if you're young, 8 weeks old, you do need satellite cells to increase the muscle size. Okay? So this was a big, we think this explains the discrepancy between our two studies, and we actually, it's one of those things where, had he not ever contacted us and forced us to really think about it, we may not have ever uncovered this fact. And so now you start to interpret that in a broader context, right? So pair this result up with what I showed you for the PAC-7 knockout, right? So there it's very clear that you needed satellite cells during postnatal development. And now we've extended that out to about 8 weeks, But now when you get to 16 weeks, right, 2 months, 4 months, now there isn't a requirement. So now the question hopefully you're asking yourself is, what is happening? What is different in a muscle, say, postnatally or in a young mouse as opposed to a mature mouse? So what is, you know, is this in a mature mouse, are the resident myonuclei, somehow they're able to compensate for a loss of satellite cells or able to adjust their behavior in response to hypertrophic stimulus, where presumably these guys, their resident myonuclei, are unable to compensate or make some type of adjustment, and they require those additional nuclei. Okay? So, that's another area, that's what we're trying, now we're trying to figure out what is the difference between, we'll say, a young myonuclei and a mature myonuclei. Because what we want to try to do is understand what is the way in which the muscle is able to compensate, right? And then can we, you know, from a research perspective, can use that information in a therapeutic, as a part of the therapeutic strategy to rescue loss of muscle mass or prevent the loss of muscle mass. So, a former graduate student, Tyler Kirby, did stuff, people refer to it as metabolic labeling, and basically what you can do is you can use this uridine analog. So uridine is unique to RNA, right? It's one of the base pairs in RNA. And so what we can do is we can inject, we call it, I don't even, ethanol uridine, we call it EU for short, because it's easier to pronounce. We can take this EU and do a IP injection into a mouse, and now, right, you're constantly making RNA, right? You're constantly transcribing your DNA into RNA, you're making RNA. We refer to that as nascent or newly made RNA. And what will happen is this EU will get incorporated into that newly made RNA. Okay, so people, you might hear me say metabolic labeling. It's a way to label nascent or newly transcribed RNA. Then through some magic of, it's called Clickit chemistry, you can literally attach either a fluorophore, right? So something that now you can visualize where that new RNA is, or alternatively, you can attach through this Clickit chemistry these magnetic beads. So now you have the ability to actually see or measure or isolate the newly transcribed RNA. And so this is a way for us, the way we think about it is, it's a way for us to measure the transcriptional output of each nuclei. Because now we can visually see it. All right? So this was Tyler's initial efforts to, so you have to, you give this EU, you inject the animal, and then you collect the muscle at some time point afterwards. And so he did some preliminary experiments where he would inject the EU, collect the muscle 1 hour, 5 hours, 8 hours, and 12 hours. And then he would take the muscle, again, this is, he's sectioning the muscle, stains it. I think this is probably laminin, right? So it'll define the border of the muscle cell, and then he attached through this Clickit chemistry a fluorophore. And so it's this pink. So what he found was if he injected EU, waited 5 hours, collected the muscle, he could detect that EU incorporation, right? And the blue are nuclei, okay? So what you see is a co-localization of the EU and the nucleus. Okay? And that this EU, think of it, it's a representation. It provides a readout of if that nucleus, how much transcription that nuclei is producing. How many mRNAs is it making during that five-hour window? So it's giving us a transcriptional, a readout of transcriptional output. Okay? So here is a figure from his paper. He basically, he's just showing you, this is, again, he did synergist ablation, okay, mechanical overload. He's just showing you that, so you have the sham, that's your control, SA, synergist ablation, for 3 days, 7 days, 14 days. You see the significant increase in muscle weight, as you would expect, right? It's a marvel of hypertrophy. Here he's showing you total RNA, and remember, we talked about total RNA is a good proxy for ribosomal RNA, right? Because it turns out that 80-85% of the RNA, when you take a muscle, you grind it up, and you isolate the RNA from that muscle. We refer to that as total RNA. 80-85% of that total RNA is ribosomal RNA. Okay? So when we see, he says, he's showing you here, the amount of total RNA normalized for the amount of muscle, okay, you see the significant increase in total RNA. So we interpret that as an increase in ribosomes. And we'll talk about this next week. We'll get into ribosome biogenesis, because this, you know, you could interpret this as an increase in the number of ribosomes, which is referred to as translational capacity, right? So the way I think about it is each ribosome, what do ribosomes do? They translate mRNA into protein, so they're like a factory, and they're making protein, right? So when you're hypertrophying, you're just making more protein, cellular protein, and I probably overly simplistically think, I'm making more myosin, making more actin, I'm making more sarcomeres. That's what we're really doing, right? And so here, you have more factories to make more protein. You increase the capacity of the cell. So then what he did is, again, this is just, in the red is the EU, can't really read that. Yeah, laminin is the green. Okay, remember, each muscle fiber is surrounded by sort of a connective tissue, a sheath called the basal lamina. So laminin is part of that, so he can, that's how he can see the size of the muscle fiber. All right, and then DAPI is the each nucleus, right? And then this is the overlay of all three of those individual images. And then what he basically did was he wanted to know, right, you have other cell types in muscle besides muscle. So all the nuclei that you see are not necessarily going to be myonuclei. So what he wanted to do was say, how many of the nuclei that are inside this laminin border also stain positive for EU labeling? And we were actually really surprised by this, that, I mean, it's upwards of 95% of the nuclei that he sees, that he could detect, right, were EU positive. 95% of the nuclei in the muscle that were EU positive were myonuclei. So again, think about that. What we're saying is, I give this uridine analog at time zero, I wait 5 hours, and I collect the muscle. During that 5 hour period, what's happening? That uridine analog is getting incorporated into newly made mRNA, right? Or really ribosomal RNA, right? Then we come and we collect the muscle at 5 hours, we section it, we stain it to see where that are, to visualize that newly transcribed RNA. And what he found was that 95% of that newly transcribed RNA localized to a myonucleus, meaning that most of the transcriptional activity in a muscle is in the mild nuclei. That those other cell types are, comparatively speaking, less transcriptionally active. Now that's really good for us because a lot of times you do experiments where you grab a muscle and you want to do gene expression analysis. You never know, you know, you always want to say whatever you're looking at is coming from the muscle fiber, but you can't say that definitively because you got all these other cell types. Well, this would give you some confidence that probably what you're seeing to some degree is coming from the muscle fiber. Yeah.
Why do you think there's that little drop in the total RNA at kind of the 14-day time point?
That's a great question.
It's interesting, right? Because the muscle weight is continuing to trend up.
Yeah, and honestly, like if you take, I don't know if you guys probably don't remember, but if you were to look at this, even when, like say, we'll go out to 8 weeks, most of the increase in muscle weight occurs in the first 2 weeks. I mean, we still see, you know, a little bit, but it's much smaller. And so I guess we've always interpreted this as you've reached some new homeostatic level. You know, you have enough ribosomes to maintain that increase in size, and you go, and again, this is normalized for muscle weight. So the muscle, it's like you've made all the ribosomes you need, but the muscle continues to grow. So when you normalize, it's right. Dropping a little bit. That's how I've interpreted that. Okay. So that's very, that was a new observation for us. So then he said, okay, well, what happens during hypertrophy? So here's EU labeled myogenic nuclei. Okay. I don't want to confuse you too much, but because we use laminin, right? If you remember, if you have the muscle cell, and right outside the membrane of the muscle cell, the satellite cell is right there, and the basal lamina surrounds the muscle cell and the satellite cell. So when we're looking at nuclei under the basal lamina, we're looking at myonuclei, nuclei within the muscle cell, and satellite cell. So we have to say myogenic. But satellite cells represent 1-2% of the nuclei in a muscle. So in general, you're really looking at myonuclei. Okay, so what he's showing here is if he counts the number of myonuclei, how many of those nuclei are EU positive? And so what he sees is about 60%. It ticks up a little bit in response after 3 days of synergist ablation. And then, surprisingly, it drops off. Okay? This in itself is an interesting observation. Why? Because it's saying only 60% of the nuclei in the muscle had any detectable transcriptional output. Does that mean the other 40% were quiescent? I don't know. Something to think about. Then we can talk about this later, but I just want to show you that there's a certain percent, you know, roughly 50% of the nuclei are EU positive. Okay? In response, now he says the EU labeled RNA per fiber. So here he's kind of like looking at how intense is that labeling. And what Tyler saw was this huge increase in EU labeling at 3 days that dropped off at 7 and 14 days. Okay? So it appears that in response to this hypertrophic stimulus, you have this huge transcriptional outburst, okay, or production, and then it falls off. Okay? Now, I know you guys are like, where is he going with this? Now, the big question is, what happens when you repeat this experiment? All of what I just showed you was all done in wild-type mice. Right? So it's sort of given us a baseline, sort of a general consensus. So the idea now is you use this metabolic labeling to look at transcriptional output, and what you see is in response to a hypertrophic stimulus, there's this huge increase in the transcriptional output of the resident myonuclei. Okay? Because satellite cell addition or myonuclear accretion doesn't occur until about day 7. So this is those resident myonuclei in response to a hypertrophic stimulus. Like, all right, we got to ramp up transcription. And that transcription is primarily going to be ribosomal DNA transcription. We're making new ribosomes. We're making more factories so that we can really ramp up protein synthesis. Okay? That's the general, sort of the working model. So what happens in a muscle that doesn't have satellite cells? What do those? What is the transcription response of those resident myonuclei? So again, this is just a representative image. I'll just direct your attention. Well, you can even hear. So remember, you saw a drop off in the number of myonuclei that were EU positive. So vehicle, tamoxifen, again, think vehicle, that's sort of your wild type. Tamoxifen, no satellite cells. So look what happens when you have no satellite cells. The number of myonuclei that are EU positive remains elevated. He went out for 14 days, right, because he wanted to make sure that he got myonuclear accretion, right? And the intensity of that label was also elevated. So the take-home message from this was that those resident myonuclei in a mature mouse somehow are able to go, there's no additional myonuclei as a result of satellite cell fusion, so guess what? We just have to keep cranking. Okay? So they, in a mature skeletal muscle, the resident myonuclei are able to compensate for having no satellite cells by maintaining their transcriptional output for a prolonged period of time. Alright? So that's what our working model is. Now, some of this that you see here, okay, or you see this here, how do we explain that? So, it's a more technical interpretation. We don't know that this is true, but what we think is probably happening is this is, I don't want to say an artifact of the experiment, right? But for us to be able to detect this EU label, it has to be very concentrated, right? If it becomes diffused, his ability to detect it is more difficult. And so what we think is really happening is that you have some type of transcriptional output that is required for hypertrophic growth. Okay? So let's just say, for argument's sake, you have a muscle fiber. It has 100 nuclei. And each nuclei puts out so much, generates so much transcriptional output. Now, you normally, at about day 7, you start getting additional nuclei. So we'll just say, for argument's sake, you go from having 100 nuclei to 150 nuclei. So now that transcriptional output can be distributed over more nuclei. So then when we try to measure that transcriptional output by EU labeling, it's below our level of detection. So it looks like, oh, you're not making, these guys just shut down transcription. That's because we know that they're transcribing, because we can see that increase in total RNA. Right? So what would you guess then? So now what I've just showed you is, in a mature muscle, if we get rid of the satellite cells, those resident myonuclei are able to compensate by keeping their transcription, right? So again, if I use the analogy of a factory, these guys, you know, most nuclei are only working two shifts, right? And then when you don't get those additional factories or additional nuclei to come in, the resident nuclei go, oh, crap, everybody's got to start working a swing shift, right? So now we're cranking 24 hours a day. But they have that ability to ramp up their transcription in the absence of satellite cells. So now we try to, what do you think might be happening in a young mouse? Where I just showed you data in a young mouse, if you get rid of satellite cells, they were unable to hypertrophy. So if we think that transcriptional output is important for that hypertrophic growth, then what would we guess or what would we propose, hypothesize, might be happening in young mice? Anybody want to bet?
They're unable to keep their transcriptional levels up.
Yes, you get star for the day. Okay, so, oh, wait a minute. I'm going to go to this one first. Oh, man. Okay, you're going to have to trust me on this. This is not four black squares. Can we turn on the other light? Maybe you guys can
see a little bit.
Can you guys see a little
bit?
Just better. You guys humor me, okay? This is really preliminary data. But we find it really exciting. So this is by Vondre. He's a postdoc in the lab. So here is, this is EU labeling, okay? Here's what you're used to seeing. Four or five month old mouse. We gave him EU. He waited 5 hours. So we're just showing you the EU label, okay? So you guys, you can see those red spots, right? Okay? He repeated what Tyler did. He did 1 hour. Look, doesn't see anything. That confirms. Now he took 2-month-old and he waited 1 hour or 5 hours. And look at, in a 2-month-old mouse with just a 1 hour pulse, right? He sees all this EU labeling. But if he goes out to 5 hours, it's gone. Okay? So we interpret that as these nuclei, which again, pretty sure they're primarily myonuclei, they, in a 1 hour period, they can label enough RNA for us to detect it. However, whereas in a 5-month-old, we couldn't detect it. It took 5 hours for us to get enough transcriptional output for us to detect it. Okay? Whereas, then you say, well, what's happening in 5 hours? We don't know, but our interpretation is, again, this is, we've caught it right where the what was just newly transcribed is still condensed so we can detect it. Whereas at 5 hours, it's already started to move out from the nucleus. I don't know if that's true or not. You guys are getting data. It's hot. So now our working model is that, in fact, the young mouse, those resident myonuclei are much more transcriptionally active, and their factory, if it's a factory, they're already working three shifts. They don't have any more, you know, they're really at some ceiling, some transcriptional ceiling. So the only way for them to ramp up transcription is they have to get additional nuclei. They've got to get in additional factories. So when we come in at 2 months of age and we get rid of satellite cells, we get rid of their ability to have additional factories, they can't ramp up transcription, so they can't hypertrophy. So let me go back now. Okay, so then the question becomes, yeah?
That's what I was trying to say on Monday's perspective. They're still lengthening, and then you're trying to get them hypertrophy, and then you take away satellite cells that are diffusing, that will just happen. And then you have the bubble and you're with the
yeah.
maturation effect. that's too much for them to ask them to also like what you're doing.
Yeah, I completely. So it's I think your point is really good. I mean, you're kind of one step ahead. Where, well, why are they transcription? Why are they more transcriptionally active at say 2 months? And probably because even though they're, and again, it's a question of rate, right? During postnatal development, growth is just enormous. But this evidence leads us to suggest that the muscles are still growing. Probably long bone growth, still hypertrophy. So they're more transcriptionally active. So putting an additional demand on them, they don't have anywhere to go. So the only way they can do that is by adding more nuclei.
Do you think the diphtherium toxin might be more, if it gets out of the cell, let's say if you use that, would it maybe harm the young cells more than the older cells, do you think? Or could that get out of the cell?
Yeah, so my understanding is one of the beauties of this system is that there's no receptor for diphtherium toxin in mammals. So when they designed the system, they said this is great because we won't get any collateral damage, right? So you have a cell, to Robin's point, you have a cell, you express this DTA, the cell dies, you know, I don't know, stuff floods out or whatever. How do you know that DTA isn't going to start killing neighboring cells? So there is a system where people actually express the diphtherium toxin receptor, and then you give diphtherium toxin. So you express a receptor in your cell type of interest, and that's a different strategy. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a really good question that we haven't even touched on. So tamoxifen, we give them a good deal of tamoxifen to really make sure that we activate the system. And we definitely do know that, you know, in a mature mouse, we really don't see much change just like looking at body weight, but we do, in fact, see an impact on body weight in the young. However, we give them a two-week washout, and by the time we do that, they recover. But to your point, that doesn't mean that you haven't done something to the muscle itself. And I think, So the control for that would be we could give one of the parental lines, like the PAC7 CREDR parental line, give two-month-old mice tamoxifen and repeat the hypertrophy study and show they're fine. So to confirm that, in fact, the tamoxifen itself wasn't toxic.
And doing things.
Yeah. Okay, so then the question is, how are those resident myonuclei in a mature muscle able to compensate for not having additional satellite cells, which may lead us into why are young myonuclei not able to. So for us, a lot of this is by understanding the mechanisms by which the muscle is able to compensate. We hope to be able to use that information to promote or prevent loss of muscle mass under different conditions. For example, with aging. Okay, I won't get to show you that stuff. I won't get to do the aging. Are they doing aging?
I think yes. Charlotte might do some.
Okay, so maybe she'll talk about that a little bit. So one thing. So how do we go about trying to figure out what could be a potential compensatory mechanism for resident myonuclei to be able to promote or sustain, so let's say promote hypertrophic growth in the absence of satellite cells. So here is a figure from a grant where we did microarray. Are you guys familiar with microarray analysis?
Yes?
No? Okay. So this is a technique where we can take the muscle, grind it up, isolate the RNA, and then they have these chips, literally they're little chips, and they pretty much have every gene that we know, about 22,000 genes on that chip. And so what a microarray allows us to do is look at the complete expression profile of the muscle. Okay, so we can look at the gene expression of every gene in the muscle. And it's a way for us to say, you know, get this global perspective of how is gene expression changing in response to, in our case, hypertrophic stimulus. Okay? So what we did is we took mice with or without satellite cells. We had the shams, so those are our controls. And then we did synergist ablation and collected the muscle after a week. And then we subjected them to isolate the RNA. And then, thank God, we have a core facility here. So you just have to give them your RNA. And then like a week or two later, they give you back this huge Excel spreadsheet with the change in the expression level of all these genes. So we looked at, and I'll talk about what cyclin D is in a minute. We looked at, there's a gene called cyclin D1, D2, and D3. And so what we're trying to show you here is, here's cyclin D2. Go over here. So here is your control. Think of your wild type, your sham. So that's just a resting muscle. And then here is synergist ablation after 1 week. So this is a muscle that's undergoing hypertrophy. And what you see is this really nice, significant increase in cyclin D1 expression. All right? Here is in a muscle that has no satellite cells, the same thing. You see the baseline is a little bit higher, all right? But you see, again, a comparable increase in cyclin D1, all right? We'll look at, here's cyclin D3, another isoform of cyclin D, and basically you see no difference whether you have satellite cells or don't. And then we come to cyclin D2. Now what you see is, because there's no asterisks here, even though this is an increase, it's not significant. Well, I can't even say that because this is only an N of 1, I think. Oh, no, there's more than that. So, yeah, so we can say it was not significant. It was up, but it didn't reach. But here's the big point. Cyclin D2, when you do not have satellite cells, its expression increases even more. All right? So this was microarray data, so then we needed to confirm this data, and Vondre just did this work, where again, think of vehicle is your wild type, tamoxifen is satellite cell depleted muscle, and so again, here's baseline, and then in response to 1 day, 3 days, 5 days, or 7 days of mechanical overload, and basically what he's showing you is that in fact, when you do not have satellite cells, presumably, right, we don't know this, we need to do additional experiments, but the idea is that those resident myonuclei upregulate cyclin D2. Okay? So, could it be that this is part of, or some aspect of, a compensatory mechanism? Okay? So, what you should be thinking now is, I don't know what kind of exams we're giving you guys here, but one idea would be, oh, well, maybe in a young mouse, they're unable to upregulate cyclin D2. That's how they're, okay? So what is cyclin D2 doing? You guys knew it was going to come back to ribosomes. I love ribosomes. Okay. I love my wife more, but I really like private. Okay. So I'm not going to ask you to know this. What I want you to know is that cyclin D can pair up with CDK4, all right? And these can work together to cause a phosphorylation. And I'll talk a lot more about this next week. But this is a transcription factor that is known to be absolutely essential for driving ribosomal DNA transcription or making new ribosomes. Okay? So what we think might be happening And this is just, and I'll go into this more next week. This is R for ribosomal RNA. There's a couple different species, 2818S. And what Vondre is showing you here is that, in fact, right, the ability of a muscle, whether it has satellite cells or not, is comparable. Okay, so ribosomal DNA transcription is the same between whether you have satellite cells or not. So your ability to make ribosomes. And again, you should go, well, there's not really any difference here, right? They're making the same amount of ribosomal RNA. But what's the difference, again, whether you have satellite cells or don't have satellite cells? Think of just a single muscle fiber. Yes. So one, if you're a wild type, a normal muscle, you go from, again, just for discussion's sake, you go from having 100 nuclei to 150 nuclei. If you have no satellite cells, you just got your 100. So what, in your mind, you could look at this and you go, so there's a certain amount of ribosomes that are being made, but this is being made with 150 nuclei. This is being made with 100 nuclei. Yeah?
Do you think the cycle B2 is just because the nuclei in the TAM are spawned or activated, so there's no difference? There could be just as many of those now that we have the nuclei.
Maybe
just dilutes out the mRNA for cycle B2 because there's other nuclei that are out and the sham.
I don't know if I can.
The same you're talking about is that there's the same number of ribosomal subunits for a fewer nuclei.
Mm-hmm.
So the same thing, if you had more nuclei that were on in the TAM versus the sham, that the same amount of RNA is isolated from both.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
They're not more on, but they're the same amount that was on. But it's just not that many people that have it.
So, I don't know if I completely understand what you're saying. So first of all, I would say, you know, when we look at the gene expression, right, we're looking at it across the whole muscle, and that typically is adjusted. Well, we can't say that we isolate from exactly the same amount of muscle. Yeah. So.
I'm saying, so if you're saying that there are a bunch of nuclei that aren't on in the sham, or in the ocean vehicle?
Well, so what, yeah, so that one interpretation down? Is that, yeah, you have, say, 50% of your nuclei in normal muscle are on, might tick up a little bit in response to the synergistic latent, response to hypertrophic stimulus. But what we can say is that compared to a satellite cell depleted muscle, more nuclei are on. Right? So are you saying that if you were to look at that increase in cyclin D, well, maybe we can just talk about it after class, but I can't. I think our general, and obviously at this point it's a simplistic, is that what we're able to do is, and I'll talk about this next week, but because we'll get more into ribosomes and ribosome biogenesis, is, so unlike, how many copies do you have of most genes? Two, right? Ribosomal DNA, there are roughly, Bailey knows this better than anybody, the general, what you'll hear in a textbook, is you have a couple hundred copies. You have 200 copies of ribosomal DNA. And that ribosomal DNA is actually spread out, from what I've read, four different chromosomes, about 50 copies, okay, per site. But you don't, all of those copies are not transcriptionally active. Only a subset of them are active. So one general idea here is you could either have more copies being activated, or those copies that are active are being transcribed at a higher rate. That's something, but we don't, you know, we don't know that.
So is this that cyclin D2 is a compensatory mechanism, or is if you're a young mouse, it's like the rate limiting factor, that you just can't get enough cyclin D2 out to initiate translation?
So I don't know. So that's so Vondre is actually doing, and if by the end of the semester I have that data, maybe I'll come back, and because I know you guys are just dying to know. I gotta know. You guys probably go home tonight and talk about it.
Are you friends?
I think this.
No. So the general idea is that. With normal growth, cyclin D1 is what is one of the mechanisms in which is driving ribosome biogenesis. Based on what I showed you, the EU labeling, right? And again, think of EU labeling, think of that as representing ribosome biogenesis. Or how much those nuclei, how much their transcriptional output. So we say, okay, we know that somehow, in the absence of satellite cell, those resident myonuclei are able to maintain their transcriptional output. And we interpret that as that's representing ribosome biogenesis. And so those, because remember I was saying, you have fewer new nuclei, so those nuclei that are there have to work harder, so that's why we're able to detect their transcriptional output. So the question is, how are they doing that? How did they go from, you know, they only had to work two shifts a day, so now all of a sudden they got to do three? How did they do that? How did they, you know, they have that reserve capacity where we're suggesting maybe a young myonucleus doesn't.
Right, but I guess just from like what we said, like, is it because they're going through development, the biosynthetic demand is just high,
yeah,
on a nucleus. So that is no longer there, to me it just makes sense, yeah, you have some reserve to ramp up your transcription.
Yep.
So I guess that's what I can't, like, that's the connection I'm not making.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So does this not occur in the young?
Yeah.
We would love to do know that.
Yeah.
And so in fact, one of the experiments that we're doing is we've created a mouse. A cyclin D2, we didn't create it. Somebody sends it to us. We're breeding a mouse in which we can deplete satellite cells. So our PAC7 DTA mouse, right, that we talked about on Monday, and now we've crossed it into a cyclin D2 knockout mouse. And the idea is that we're going to completely prevent this, and does that prevent epitrophic growth? Again, you guys, I'm giving you guys, like, this is work in progress, and in part, I like to share because I like, you know, the more minds thinking about stuff, the better, right? But this is what we think, or at least this is our model of what we think might be happening, okay? But I see what you're saying, I do. And we could be absolutely wrong. You know, you take data and you try to, you know, I look at the microarray data and I try to see what's different, and we saw this difference, and, you know, Vondre's our resident ribosome biogenesis expert, so he's the one who educates me on, you know, this pathway, and that possibly you could be having augmentation of cyclin D1 activation of ribosome biogenesis. So just to summarize, finish out, How are we doing on time?
Good. Like another 10 minutes.
Okay.
Five,
this won't take me 10. So here is, this is from Kevin's, I think this is a review article, maybe even the paper. But basically what we're trying to show is compare between young mice and what we refer to as mature mice. And the general notion is this is what you would typically see, right? Mononuclear accretion, some notion that you're maintaining the mononuclear domain by increasing mononuclear number. However, in the absence of satellite cells, those resident mononuclei are unable to sustain or promote hypertrophic growth. The question at this point is, why is that? And our hope is that it'll, by understanding this, this will tell us something just fundamental about muscle biology, and more in particular about the processes that govern muscle growth and how they change with age. The other end of the spectrum, which I won't get to talk about, is with aging. Okay, so that's sort of the continuum. Right? And then in a mature mouse, what we basically are showing you is, again, you get with satellite cells, you have an increase in myonuclei. You're able to sustain, think that maintains this myonuclear domain, and that allows hypertrophic growth. However, in the absence of satellite cells, these resident myonuclei are able to increase their transcriptional output. All right, and in that they're able to support a larger myonuclear domain. Okay. And so the unanswered question is, why is there a difference? What is the difference in these resident myonuclei? And our working hypothesis is that we think that these guys, because the animal is still growing, they are still under, their transcriptional output is still very quite high, relatively speaking. And so when you ask them to do more, they're unable to do more. And what I mean by more is, we think, make more ribosomes, okay? Which would, is necessary to increase protein synthesis and lead to hypertrophic growth. Whereas these guys, they've reached sort of the muscle has stopped growing, so they're at a more homeostatic level, so they have some reserve capacity, and in that they're able to ramp up their transcriptional output, make additional ribosomes, which allows them to increase their sustained rate of protein synthesis. Okay, and so in the end, you get hypertrophic growth. Okay, I think that's it. I'm going to stop there, and then we'll start. You guys probably won't even be able to contain yourself over the weekend because we're going to talk about ribosomes and ribosome biogenesis. So, yes, you guys are terribly excited. I would say on the exam, my questions, you put down ribosomes, you'll probably get at least 50%.